Everyone, and welcome to Resting Witch Face, your one-stop haunt for all things spooky, bitchy, and more. I'm Bailey Bennett.
I'm Grant Jacoby.
I feel like I always open this podcast with like my phone voice.
Oh,
you know, do you have one?
It's definitely a lot higher.
Yeah, I could see you being very no-nonsense on the phone.
I mean, I kind of talk like this.
Okay.
And like, okay. Oh, hi.
Yeah.
This is Grant Jacoby. I'm calling from your mom.
Mm-hmm.
And,
Yeah. This is Bailey Bennett. I fucked your mom last night, so...
She says thank you.
Just wanted to let you know. Thank you. Welcome to another episode of our podcast.
Yeah, we love having you here on this lovely Tuesday morning.
Mm-hmm.
When we release our episode.
Oh, yeah. I was like, it's not Tuesday, but...
No, it's...
I get it. Just to update you guys, Grant does have a sweat towel today.
I do.
Just to dab away those beads.
I did. I brought it with me just because I decided to take
smart.
A 45-minute walk over. And I grabbed it last second because I was like, oh, I don't probably need this. But then within 20 of the 45 minutes walking here, I was like, I definitely do.
Right. Yeah. Well, good for you. I'm glad you got those steps in.
Thank you.
I know we have a little bit of a long... story
we
this
do.
Week.
We've got a real
I don't know what it is, but I've heard.
So who is our badass bitch this week?
Well, let me tell you. This was actually a suggestion from a listener named Tabitha. And this is a bitch that we have mentioned before, but I feel like it's just worth reiterating. And I wanted to just talk about Danica Rome a little bit. Just because like you know what? Pride Month is over, but it's Pride Month always.
Yeah, every
and
month is Pride Month.
And Danica is really fucking awesome. So for those of you who don't know, she is the first openly transgender woman to be elected to and seated in the U.S. state legislature. And she's just a real inspiration. So she was elected to... In 2017, she was elected to the Virginia House of Delegates, winning the Democratic primary for the 13th district and in the general election on November 7th. So she was the first openly transgender person to be elected to the Virginia General Assembly. And then in January 2018, became the first to be both elected and serve while openly transgender in any state legislature. So she's just a true public servant and someone who just wants the best for her state. Like she was born and raised in Virginia and just really, really cares about what's going on there and really cares about those small town, hometown issues. She was a journalist for a long time and was just covering like, you know, those smaller things that are happening on the day to day and really kind of wanted to take her fight to the government. And she has this really great quote where she talks about like, she's obviously openly trans and is very proud of her identity as a trans woman and has this great quote where she says, it's not I'm trans, but it's I'm trans and I'm trans and I'm a wonderful legislator. Like I'm trans and I have a great bill to solve this issue that's affecting the people in my town. And I think she obviously serves as a huge inspiration for not only the trans community and the queer community, but for anyone who's ever felt like they were an outsider or a minority or just needed to really fight for what they believed in and to fight for their basic human rights. So, yeah, I think she's just incredible. I hope that she's the first of many to kind of trailblaze in the government in that way. Like I'm sure she will be. And it is really, it's really tough because I know like during the election process, her opponent was targeting her for the fact that she was trans and refusing to use her pronouns. And yeah, oh and God. Just like trying to fault her for that. I believe Bob Marshall was her opponent who was being a real fucking dick. So yeah, it says during her campaign, Marshall tried to use her gender identity against her by continuously disrespecting her preferred pronouns and refusing to debate her, which is like so cool. Like
real stand up.
Awesome.
That's the person I want in office.
He also faulted her for the fact that she used to be a vocalist in a death metal band called Cab Ride Home, which is fucking amazing. Yeah, like,
that's so sick.
Yeah, it's fucking sick. Like, she is awesome. And yeah, I just, you know, want to highlight her forever, but that's, she's our badass special this week.
Love that.
Yeah. And thank you, Tabitha, for bringing that to our attention. Obviously, she was on our radar already. Totally. And I believe we mentioned her back when, like, the elections were happening, but always important to reiterate.
Absolutely. We love. And actually, that's actually, I'm happy you did this one because we posted this recently that, let me actually pull it up right now. So I have the information in front of us that the first transgender suicide hotline is now up and running in the US. It's called Trans Lifeline. And if you need it, or if you know someone who could need it, the number is 877-565-8860. Again, that's 877-565-8860. And it's super important. And I think it's amazing that that exists. And I hope that it can be a really great resource for our trans family in need.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to one last thing was I read a quote from Danica where she talked about during her transition, how the people in her life, like, really just didn't make a big deal out of it. And we're just like, yeah, of course, that's your identity. Like, we totally accept you that way. And, like, we'll do whatever you need. But, like, business as usual, carry on with our lives. Like, this is who you are. And maybe that's not what everyone needs. But I think in general, if you have someone in your life who is going through a transition like that, obviously acknowledging it is important and being there as a support system is important. But also just remembering that they're the same person you've always known. And, like, they want you to see them
for who they are.
Yeah, exactly. Great. So, I don't know. Let's get up to into whatever fucked up thing you brought here today.
Yeah. So, I mean, those who've seen the title of this episode already know what this is about. Bailey, you know that I love a good unsolved murder. And I had this realization. This is the unsolved murder of Faith Hedgepeth.
I don't know this.
Yeah, I didn't know this one either until... Okay. And I was actually really hesitant to do this because the podcast, The Murder Squad, with Billy Jensen, Paul Holes, just did this story.
Okay.
But I'd never heard of it.
Yeah.
I listened to the episode and I just, like, could not stop thinking about it. And so I just, like, on my own, I just started doing, like, more, like, research, which then, like, led me down, like, a bunch of, like, Reddit black holes. And I started watching some, like, Investigation Discovery episodes.
Oh my God.
And I was like, I literally need to talk about this story with you because it's so crazy. It's so fucked up. And it hasn't been solved.
Spoiler alert. God. Well, we're going to solve it here today. Yes. So don't even worry about that.
But I feel like I came to this, like, little, like, aha moment in regards to, like, maybe why, not even so much, like, why we're obsessed with serial killers, but, like, why serial killers are, like, sometimes, like, differently viewed than just, like, a straight up just, like, murder.
Okay.
And I think it's because, like, we did talk about Ted Bundy a couple weeks ago. And, like, while you did, like, an amazing job of, like, reading out, like, all of the victims' names, at least the ones have been identified, it's, I feel like once you have, like, multiple victims, it's easily becomes, like, desensitized. And, like, you start, I think the brain suddenly, like, starts, like, shifting. And, like, while, like, you can acknowledge that there are people, obviously there are people, it just becomes a list of names. And I feel like you start to kind of shut down and you're like, oh my God, like, you're still like, oh my God, this is so horrible. But
totally.
You don't have the same, I think a certain level of empathy emerges when you're just talking about a singular case.
Definitely. And I think there's, like, this terrible dark thing that happens where you start, like, comparing different serial killers and you're like, oh, well, that guy only killed 5 people. Well, like, yeah, this other one are killed like 37. It's like, and it's like, obviously there's no competition, but I do think that, like, it's easier to just not think about the fact that those were each individual lives and like they had all the ramifications from each individual case. And but
I don't know, just a little moment I thought of where I was like, oh, like, I feel like just, I think that sometimes when you are obsessed with true crime and murder as we are, that I think you kind of go into this, like, certain state when you're reading about serial killers or, you know, killers, spree killers or whoever, who have a lot of victims.
Yeah.
Where you're able to be like, oh, you just, like, your brain shuts down.
Yeah.
In the sense of.
You have to, because you can't. Otherwise, like, how can you process that? But it's also the really fascinating thing of being like, okay, this person had this one victim and why this one singular victim? Whereas when it comes, like, a serial killer is often comes down to, like, this person just couldn't help themselves from killing for whatever fucked up reason, like, they could not stop themselves, and whoever was in their path, or, like, whoever had brown hair, like, is who they went after. Whereas, like, when it's a murder that's just like this one.
Watch those middle parts, ladies, especially if you're in the Pacific Northwest. Anyways, come along with me, will you, to North Carolina.
Okay.
Back to Faith. So Faith Hedgepath was born in 1992 in Warren County.
I was born in 1992.
Oh, I know.
Okay.
She's a little baby.
Okay.
Part of the traditional territory of the, I'm probably going to mispronounce this, so I apologize in advance, Haliwa Saponi Native American tribe, of which she was a member.
Okay.
Her parents divorced within a year of her birth, and she was raised by her mother, Connie, with help from an older sister, with help from her older sister. Mm-hmm. Connie said that she named her daughter Faith because she believed that that was exactly what she needed to raise a fourth child when she already had two sons and a daughter and a husband with a drug problem.
Ugh, that's so hard.
Super hard.
And it is unfortunately very common in the, I know in like the Native American community that they struggle a lot with alcoholism and drug abuse and so many other issues with how they're treated in general. But
that's a horse of a different color. It is a little confusing. I think her parents do eventually reconcile because I know that her father definitely at a certain point, I think, kicks his drug habit and becomes definitely a part of her life because he's very involved and often filmed with her mother in a lot of these different crime shows that I've watched. So that's a good guess. Faith was a high school honor student, a cheerleader, and a member of many extracurricular clubs. She earned a scholarship to attend the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where my sister went, where she hoped to be the first in her family to graduate from college. So she was like, and everyone said that she was just like, I mean, you hear this all the time with, unfortunately, in a case like this, like she could light up a room. Like she was like everyone loved her. She was super charismatic and energetic and friendly and just like a really, really good person.
Yeah.
Not that if she was a shitty person that she deserved to die, but.
Of course not. You know, but also when you're coming out of like, she's really coming out of some difficult circumstances and making the most of her life, which is amazing.
And like wanted to better herself and better her, you know, her family. And she also had further desires to either become a pediatrician or a teacher. Within her first 2 years at UNC Chapel Hill, her first 2 years at UNC Chapel Hill went well for her, although she ended up having to take the spring of 2012 off due to a slipping in her grades and her losing her scholarship or being in jeopardy of losing her scholarship. But she fully planned on re-enrolling in the fall of 2012, and she remained in Chapel Hill over the summer, living in an off-campus apartment at the Hawthorne at the View complex between Chapel Hill and Durham.
Mm-hmm.
And during the month of August, she planned to move to another apartment complex after her financial aid for the fall semester was made available for her. She shared the one-bedroom apartment that she was staying at with Karina Rosario, whom she had been best friends with since her freshman year. Faith had moved in after Karina's ex-boyfriend, Eric Takoy Jones, had left. So the apartment had been shared with Karina and her ex-boyfriend, and after he had kicked out, Faith had moved in, and I think basically was just like crashing on the couch for the summer until another place was available. The relationship between Eric and Karina had been riddled with domestic violence, and eventually she ended it and he moved out. However, in early 2012, he had attempted to break into the apartment twice, even after Karina had changed the locks. Faith had drove Karina to the court to get a protective order that required Eric Takoy Jones stay away from the apartment. In the report, Karina details how he broke down their front door, broke several other doors in the apartment out of anger, because apparently he had a thing for doors. Pushed Karina to the ground and verbally assaulted her.
Ugh.
Eric reportedly resented Faith's influence over Karina and at one point reportedly threatened during a phone conversation with Faith to kill her if he could not get back together with Karina.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so he was a real piece of shit.
And that's so scary to imagine like moving in with your best friend while this is happening.
Oh yeah.
Like,
and apparently he also, even though he left that apartment, he still lived within the same apartment complex.
Oh God.
So he was not that far.
And also, like, it sounds like it's not like they have like a ton of money to just be like, we'll just move somewhere else.
And they're also 19.
Yeah.
They're children.
Yeah.
I can't imagine living in my own apartment at 19.
No. Well, I mean, a lot of people did that in college, but our college famously had no apartments.
Yeah, no apartments. We were just like forced to live in
dorms forever.
I mean, I loved it.
But. Same. Okay.
The evening of Thursday, September 6th, 2012, began with Faith attending a Rush event at 5:45 for the campus chapter of Alpha Pi Omega, a historically Native American sorority that she hoped to join.
Mm-hmm.
At 7:15, she left, saying that she had to work on a paper she was writing about the history of her tribe. She and Karina went to the university's library to study together at around 8 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Faith left Karina at the library briefly and returned around 11:30, at which point they returned to their apartment together around midnight. Half an hour later, they left again, heading for Thrill, a nightclub in downtown Chapel Hill, which admitted customers under the legal drinking age of 21 to dance. Even just like reading that, I'm like, I'm exhausted. It's like you left at 12:30.
I know.
So late.
I'm like thinking back to our college days. Wait, we'll share. We have a great story about college for Grant that I'll share as a treat at the end of the story.
Okay. is it about the puzzle?
Yes.
Okay. But I feel like even, I mean, I think we wouldn't go to, we didn't really go to a super like bar school.
No.
But I was thinking, like, we would be up until, like, 2 or 3 in the morning.
Definitely.
But I feel like we were, like, parties started around, like, 10.
Yeah, definitely 11, early, like, definitely earlier than that.
12:30.
Yeah.
I do remember first moving to New York, and I was staying with our friend Tori, and I was like, oh, like, so, like, what bars are we going to go to? Like, blah, blah. And she's like, what time should we be going out? She's like, well, we won't even start pre-gaming until, like, 11. And I was like, I don't understand what you're saying to me. I'm like, can we start pregaming at 3:30 p.m. and can we in bed by 7?
Love you, Tori.
blah blah blah. So yes, so the two women arrived at Thrill around 12:40 a.m. and after almost an hour and a half of dancing, Karina complained about having an upset stomach and wanted to leave. It's unclear if she was feeling sick or if she just had too much to drink.
Mm-hmm.
Security cameras at the club show she and Faith leaving at 2:06 a.m. With a couple of other friends. It is the last visual record of Faith's presence anywhere before her death.
Mm.
At 3 a.m., Faith and Karina returned to their apartment. A woman who lived below the two was awake, watching television around the same time, and she reported hearing three thumping noises, which she described as similar to a heavy bag being dropped or furniture being overturned.
Mm.
Basically what we've been hearing upstairs while Bailey's fiance is having a magic tournament.
Sorry.
Faith's Facebook page was accessed around the same time, which is about 3 a.m. Let me know if I'm going too fast.
Okay, no, I get it.
Yeah, so they're at the club, they came back, or allegedly came back, and apparently Faith's Facebook page was accessed.
But they don't know if it was accessed by her?
Well, yeah, that is the...
Okay.
There's a lot of questions and a lot of theories and a lot of things to unpack.
Okay.
We're just starting with a timeline.
Okay.
If you have any questions, I probably spent a good 10 hours researching this.
Amazing.
This week, so I've, not that I'm by no means an expert, but
okay.
I'm
sure I will happy have to questions. I'm following so far.
Cool. At 3:40 a.m., a text was sent from Faith's phone to Karina's kind of on and off other boyfriend or fling, Brandon Edwards,
okay,
saying, "Hey, B, can you come over here, please? Rosario needs you more. Aha, you know. Please let her know you care."
What?
3 minutes later, another text was sent from Faith's phone to Brandon's with a single word, "van," believed to be a correction for the aha in the previous text, which if you read, sounds like this. Hey, if it was
right
correctly, "Hey, B, can you come over here, please? Rosario needs you more than you know. Please let her know you care."
But that's still a really weird thing to say.
Really, really weird.
Okay.
At 4:16 a.m., Brandon sent a return text asking who the previous text was from, indicating that he did not have Faith's number saved in his phone.
Okay.
Official reports say this is the last activity from Faith's phone, but on and off boyfriend Ty Michael McNeil, who Faith was seeing at Chapel Hill, claims she sent him several texts around 3:50 a.m., about 10 minutes after these texts were sent to Brandon Edwards, professing her undying love for him and apologizing for blowing him off earlier to go to Thrill. He is convinced that these texts came from Faith, although her father has commented that her lack of punctuation and correct grammar in the text seems suspicious and very unlike Faith.
Yeah.
Which I think is really tricky because on the one hand, like, I'm sure it's easy to look at something like she would never type like that. Like,
right.
There's horrible grammar. But I think you and I are pretty good with our grammar.
Yeah.
Specifically, it was like the wrong "your" or something.
Okay.
It's like these things happen, typo, especially if you've been out. It's 4 a.m. You've been drinking. Like, you never know.
What year was this?
2012.
Okay. So there wasn't even necessarily like... I was abroad. So it wasn't even like, it's like an iPhone and there's like autocorrect on it. There could, it could,
it is iPhones.
It isn't, okay. But like maybe, because now I'm like, oh, I feel like I have less typos because of autocorrect, but like autocorrect used to be terrible.
That's true. Oh, I mean, it still is.
It still is, but like.
Always ducking.
But I will say like her addressing Brandon as B is a very like colloquial thing to do for someone who doesn't even have your number in their phone. Okay.
Karina's phone records show that she also was trying to call Brandon around the same time. He did not answer, and when he did not, she tried to call Jordan McCrary, a UNC Chapel Hill soccer player who she knew. So it's unclear why like all these text messages are like blasting out to all these boys.
Right.
But you know, you get in your feelings late at night. At 4:25 a.m., Karina left the apartment to get in Jordan's car along with another male friend.
Wait, who's Jordan?
Another boy that she had called once Brandon didn't answer the phone.
Okay, but so she's not hooked. She's not seeing that guy.
I think that both she and Faith were seeing dating multiple guys.
Yeah. Okay.
Faith definitely had an on-off boyfriend from high school, and then she also had this on-off boyfriend. I forget his name, and an on-off boyfriend from college named Ty Michael McNeil. And Karina had Eric Tekoy Jones, who was her ex-boyfriend who was abusive, and she was also seeing this guy Brandon Edwards. And it seems like when Brandon Edwards didn't answer the text that came from Faith's phone, as well as Karina's phone calls, she called this other guy Jordan McCrary. Unclear if he was just a friend or
okay, because she like what was wrong.
Well, that's what we don't know, because she left the club at 2 a.m. saying she was feeling sick.
Yeah.
But then at 4:30, she leaves the apartment that she shares with with Faith to get in Jordan's car along with another male friend. At that time, Karina said later, she believed that Faith was asleep in her room, but somehow left the apartment's door unlocked for unknown and extremely suspicious reasons.
She left the apartment unlocked.
So she's leaving her friend. It's the middle of the night.
Yeah.
She's leaving her friend alone in the apartment. This is now 2 months after her ex-boyfriend has tried numerous times to break into the apartment and lives in the same apartment complex. But for some reason, in the middle of the night, she's leaving after complaining of stomach problems and leaving the door unlocked.
I mean, I could see her like maybe just forgetting to lock the door if she was like drunk or it was like really late. But also like, why is she? So does Jordan say why she left?
No one knows.
So is Karina not seen again?
No, she is. There's Karina. Okay. Karina has been very, she's the divisive character in this story because she has not commented and will not comment on it. Basically since. So there's a lot of unknown information, which has lead to a lot of speculation in this crime.
Okay.
We will get to it. Don't worry.
Okay.
So Jordan drove Karina home, to the home of another acquaintance on West Longview Street in Chapel Hill, arriving around 4:30. After spending the rest of the night there in the early morning, at a short time after 10:30, she began to try to arrange a ride home. After attempting to reach Faith, who did not answer, Karina instead called another friend, Marisol Rangel, who came and took her back to the apartment. So the two girls arrived there shortly before 11 a.m., where they entered and called for Faith, who did not respond. Entering the bedroom, they found Faith's body hanging off the bed over a pool of blood.
Oh, my God.
With her black shirt pulled up over her head. She had no clothes on from the waist down. There was blood splatter on the closet, walls, and pillows, and a bloody tampon was lying beside her on the bed. The autopsy determined that Faith had died from blunt force trauma to the head, likely a result of being hit by an empty rum bottle found near the body.
Oh, my God.
If you don't like gross things, skip ahead. She died brutally and violently with multiple contusions to her face, skull, and eyes, with the fatal blow being a laceration just above her right ear. However, she put up one hell of a fight, confirmed by cuts and bruises on her arms and legs, and blood found underneath her fingernails.
Oh.
Semen was also found on the scene, but it was not reported where. While her body was sexually staged, it is unclear if she was actually sexually assaulted.
Okay.
Well,
what I'm going to say right off the bat is if there's semen and, like, blood and probably, like, flesh under her fingernails, seems like you'd be able to find that person.
You would think. So I hope I'm not getting ahead of myself, but the thing about the semen is, and this is actually was brought up in the Murder Squad.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Holes talks about this, is he bases like, so the police are very weird. And for an unknown reason, they, and actually ones involve a lot of boring research. They actually don't release details of the investigation to the public for almost 2 years, which is apparently very unlike the Chapel Hill police. So the only thing that's been reported is that semen was found in the apartment. Now, whether, and basically Paul was basically like, okay, if it was found like vaginally, it was like found inside Faith, like vaginally or anally, that obviously implies that sex, yeah, either consensual or non-consensual, had occurred. If it had been, but it could have been like any number of hours before her death. Mm-hmm. If it was in her mouth, I'm sorry, this is really graphic. It probably was closer to, it would have been like very close to her death.
Yeah.
But also it could be like, it was found on the sheets. At which point, there are a lot of boys coming in out of this apartment, mm-hmm, rightfully so. Yeah. 19,
right,
get it in. Like, who cares? And the other thing is that it's unclear what the blood was found underneath her fingernails, because some people have pointed out that, like, if you are, it could be like the first or second blow. Mm-hmm. She puts her hand up to her head to feel her wound, as you often do when you like cut yourself. You're like, ah, like, what is this?
Sure.
It could be even her own blood.
It could be period blood.
Yeah. The tampon is very confusing.
That is very confusing.
And it's so some people say like that implies that whoever killed her removed the tampon to rape her.
Yeah.
Or they wanted to stage it to look like a rape, so they saw she had a tampon in and then removed it. I don't know. So, it's really fucked up. God. It gets worse. I'm sorry. Well, actually, no. That's actually the real gross stuff. But
okay,
here's where things start getting a little weird and very complicated.
Okay.
So as I mentioned, for unknown reasons, the details of the investigation were not discussed publicly at first, a deviation of the Chapel Hill's usual procedure and practice. Mm-hmm. In fact, the town obtained a court order sealing of all records as they were collected and were not released until 2014, nearly 2 years after the murder. So we have the scene. Karina and Marisol are coming back to the apartment around 11 a.m. and find Faith's body. Mm-hmm. So Karina claims that upon finding Faith, she immediately calls 911. Mm-hmm. The call was recorded and is available online. I've listened to it.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I should have said, I got this information from Wikipedia, The Murder Squad, which I mentioned, True Crime Diary, Gaspa Writes, and ID's Breaking Homicide.
Oh my God. Look at you doing your fucking research.
I want to try and like, if I'm citing other, especially other podcasts, I'm like,
it's
really important that,
of course. And like,
where I'm getting this information from.
People should check out that podcast.
So on The Murder Squad, they do play the 911 call, which I wasn't expecting.
Oh, wow.
I was like, oh, do I want to listen to it? But it's really, really crucial.
Okay.
It is worth noting that people in great states of panic, grief, or fear do not usually respond in the typical or expected manners. Mm-hmm. However, the 911 call made on the morning of September 7th was odd at best. Uh-huh. For starters, Karina starts when the dispatcher addresses her, being like, 911's your emergency. Her first response is, hi,
Okay.
Basically, like, hi, we need help. Uh-huh. Which people have pointed out is very strange and an oddly polite.
Uh-huh.
Like, if you're calling 911, you'd think someone would be like, we need help right now. Yeah. Like, this is, like, blah, blah, blah is going on. Instead of saying hi, which is very pleasantries, and then saying, which is an indication of
what do I say? Gathering your thoughts. Yeah. Like, okay.
Which is weird. Furthermore, the caller only identifies herself as Karina after repeated requests from the dispatcher for her name. Uh-huh. She also never mentions Marisol by name, nor that anyone else was with her in the apartment when she found Faith's body.
Okay.
The caller also does not mention Faith by name in the call that lasts nearly 8 minutes.
Oh my God.
She only describes the body she has come upon as, in quote, her friend. Uh-huh. She also says over and over again, someone must have been in here, and once adding, it looks like someone has been in here there because she's not like this at all.
She's not like what?
I don't know why. I don't know why she's bleeding.
What?
It's weird.
I don't know why she's bleeding.
And she says over and over again, someone must have been in here. Like someone had to have come in here. I don't know what's going on. Like how did, like what's going on? Like she keeps saying over and over again. And it's like, so easily she could be in a state of shock.
Yeah.
But you have your best friend hanging off the bed in a pool of blood. And she keeps saying, like, there's blood everywhere.
Yeah.
But she keeps saying, like, I don't know what's wrong. I don't know what happened. Someone must have come in.
Yeah, it's like, obviously.
Yeah, and, like, why are you already trying to, like...
Can you also, like...
Why are you trying to convince the, like, the 911 operator?
Totally.
That also, like... I wasn't here. Someone must have been here.
Totally.
Lastly, the caller also seemed highly reluctant to touch Faith's body despite repeated pleas from the dispatcher to at least see if she was still breathing.
Yeah, true.
So in the 911 call, she keeps saying, because obviously the operator's like, I don't know what's going on. She keeps saying like she's not like breathing, but she's like, okay, well, can you go, like, where is she? Is she on her back? Can you can you touch her? Like, is she cold? What's going on? And it takes her a long, long, long time to get her to actually go over and touch her. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, if Karina was so inconsolable and unable to bring herself to do it, could she not have asked Marisol to?
Right.
Who apparently is in the room with her and yet is never mentioned on the 911 call.
Weird.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you think he would be like, hi, we found her. Like,
yeah,
we're here. Like, and she keeps, and she also keeps saying like, when are the police coming? Like, instead of like, almost like she doesn't want to be alone, but she's not alone.
Uh-huh.
And again, I am no voice analysis expert, but it doesn't sound like someone, it sounds like someone who's putting on the airs that they've been crying.
Okay.
It's very much like, I'm talking to you like this and I sound really upset, but as you can see right now, like, oh, there are no tears.
Yeah. Okay. Like, okay.
But again, who knows?
Sure, sure.
So these aspects of the phone, of the 911 call bring up these two theories. One, that it was actually not Karina who made the 911 call herself, but it was in fact Marisol.
Okay.
Who was friends with Faith, but not as close with her, thus referring to her as her friend, as opposed to my best friend, or even my roommate.
Yeah.
And taking so long to identify herself. Furthermore, when interviewed for ID's Breaking Homicide in 2018, Karina will not be interviewed for anything, but Marisol, who's interviewed for this episode, is nearly inconsolable 6 years later, crying and getting choked up in a very similar demeanor to the voice on the phone.
Mm.
Furthermore, in this interview, she uses a lot of buzzwords that were used in the 911 call, such as how there was blood everywhere, how she tried to tell herself that Faith was merely unconscious and not dead, and that how she couldn't bring herself to touch Faith despite the pleas to the 911 operator. Which is like, why would she know that the operator kept telling her to touch her if she wasn't the one on the phone?
Can they not do any kind of like analysis to see if it was her voice or not?
I mean, it's two 19-year-old girls who are like in alleged hysterics. So I think it's too hard to tell.
Okay.
At least that's my suspicion.
Okay.
And number two, second theory, whoever was the caller, Karina or Marisol, that they did not actually call 911 upon immediately finding Faith.
Uh-huh.
This aspect was made even more suspicious when Marisol told Faith's family that they found her at 10 a.m.
Uh-huh.
But the 911 call wasn't made until 11.
Uh-huh.
And neighbors reported seeing Karina after the time of the 911 call, and she was walking down a flight of stairs and was not visibly upset, but that she was texting.
Okay.
Regardless, why was there no indication that there was more than one caller in the apartment, especially since the dispatcher said numerous times that she will stay with the caller on the line until the police arrive so that she is not alone?
Uh-huh. Yep.
So there's a lot to unpack.
Yeah.
Just that. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot more weird shit that happens.
God, this is fascinating.
So yeah, it's very stressful.
Okay.
So that's just take that in. Take that with what you will.
Okay.
So that's the 911 call.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the note.
Oh.
Found on the bed next to Faith's body was a sloppily written message. Written on the torn-off bottom of a bag from a fast food restaurant, which was thought to be Time Out, a popular 24-hour restaurant in Chapel Hill that would have been the only place open at the time Faith and Karina left the nightclub Thrill.
Okay.
The note reads, I'm not stupid, bitch, jealous.
That's it?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not stupid, bitch. Like, so I'm like not stupid, bitch, period?
Let me see if I can...
Jealous question mark?
No question mark. It's like, I'm not stupid, bitch. Jealous. Give me 1 second.
Okay, this is the first thing my mind jumps to is Faith heard Karina and her boyfriend fighting and wrote down what she heard them saying.
Hmm.
Like, she's like I'm...
It's almost like three separate thoughts. I'm not stupid.
It looks like three
bitch,
separate thoughts.
Jealous.
Yeah. I don't know. That's the first thing that my mind goes to is she's like... She's trying to record something that she heard.
I don't know why.
Okay.
So investigators have not said whether they have had the handwriting analyzed, but the website Crime Watch Daily had an expert named Peggy Walla look at the photos of the note. She noted that it was clean of the blood reportedly found spattered all over the room.
Yep.
Suggesting that it was either written away from the crime scene or beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
The writer may have also been using their non-dominant hand in an attempt to disguise their handwriting.
Interesting.
Walla believes that the writer was particularly agitated, likely to the point of homicidal rage, by being called stupid, which, like...
Okay.
Okay. Like, so chill out. News and Observer reporter Tom Gasparoli, who's devoted his own blog to keeping the case alive and who has raised the most of the speculation about the 911 call, wonders if the words may have been intended to be read in a different order, producing wording that makes more sense, as in, "I'm not jealous, stupid bitch."
I don't know. Why would you do that?
I don't know. In addition, he theorizes that more than one writer may have been involved or that it may not have been written at the same time. Someone once, like, another, I forget who she who was interviewed on the Murder Squad, but she comments, like, maybe someone wrote, like someone wrote, "I'm not stupid, bitch," and then someone else wrote, like, "jealous." Mm. Like, it's almost like it was, like back and forth.
Okay.
Okay. I'm clear.
Mm-hmm.
The word "stupid" especially looks to Gasparoli as if it might have been written separately from the other words. I just said that. As it was written much more clearly and off to the side. In particular, he said that the P in "stupid" looks quite different and more precise than any other letter in the note. We'll post this note to Instagram, by the way.
Okay.
Gasparoli suggests that this could have come from a female writer or at least one calmer and more intelligent than the other lettering elsewhere on the note. I don't know how you get this from that because it looks like a bunch of scribble to me. But,
yeah.
Gasparoli further questioned, in fact, what the purpose of the note even was.
Yeah.
If it were a message to Faith, then it made no sense to leave it next to her body if she was dead.
Right.
If it was written by the killer or killers, it could have been particularly incriminating evidence.
Yeah.
Therefore, he believes that it's a red herring of sorts left there to confuse investigators about the real motive behind Faith's murder.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the crime scene could have been possibly staged. Mm-hmm. So,
which I think maybe is why there's so much to solve.
Yeah. Did they find the pen?
I don't. There's investigators have been very, very tight-lipped. Like, in any interview I've seen, they're basically like, "We're looking into a lot of leads." We'll get to that.
Okay.
I don't want to get ahead of myself because the third and I find the most unsettling piece of evidence that is obtained in a very upsetting and unsettling case.
Okay.
Is so we had the 911 call, we have the note, and now there's the voicemail.
Okay.
So left as a butt dial sent from Faith's phone to her friend Yuna was this voicemail.
Oh my God.
She initially, Yuna initially deleted it after being unable to discern what was being said in the message and just thinking that, like, oh, it was just like a butt dial. Like,
yeah.
I'm sure you've had those where you're just like, you hear like 30 seconds, you're like, I don't know what this is, and then deletes it.
Sure.
However, when she learned of Faith's death, she had the police actually retrieve the voicemail. The three-minute voicemail is of a conversation between what appears to be Faith, an unidentified female, and one or two unidentified males with music in the background. It was seen as mostly inaudible and of minimal evidentiary value until Crime Watch Daily hired audio expert Arlo West, who specializes in enhancing such recordings.
Mm-hmm.
Here are some of the excerpts of what West claims can be extracted based on removing background noise and other enhancing techniques.
Also, what time was this call made?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
So I'm going to read it to you now. This is taken as a combination of what was reported on the Murder Squad, and also I've listened to the recording in its entirety. It is very, very hard. Even with being enhanced, it is extremely hard to make out.
Okay.
So take this with a grain of salt. However, when you read it, when you see it with the writing over it,
yeah,
it's pretty convincing.
Okay.
So here's what is reportedly recorded. Female: "You want to mess with my boyfriend?" Faith: "I said I don't want to, Rosie." Female: "Oh, right, it's his fault." Male: "All this bullshit you're going to answer to." Inaudible. Female: "Fuck you, I'm pissed." Inaudible. Inaudible just means they couldn't.
Of course, yeah.
Male: "Inaudible, good thing." Inaudible: "Dave's house. It would be broadcast, Big Mike?" Question mark. Female: "You motherfucker." Faith: "No." Female: "I'm going to kick your face, bitch. I figured out that's bullshit. Don't ever think that I would have believed you. Lies, inaudible, at you, inaudible." Faith: "Ow." Female, mockingly, like, "Ow."
Ugh.
So she says, "Ow," back at her. Female: your talk ain't sure ain't funny. You know, he's gonna inaudible you and fuck you. I will fuck you, bitch."
What?
Faith screams. Female: "Mm-hmm." Faith: "Let me go." Male, inaudible: "Faith, help me." Female: "Don't be a pussy, put up a fight." Male:
"What?
Then you fuck her." All inaudible: "I'll fuck her." Inaudible. Faith: "Inaudible. Ow, my head." Female: "Inaudible. Do it." Male: "Inaudible. I think she's dying." Male:
"What?
Do it anyhow."
Oh my God.
Male: "Inaudible. Get the duct tape next to inaudible. Then they can tie up Faith." Faith: "Please, inaudible, me. My hands are on fire. Help." Male, put her hands behind her head. Male, I'll untie them. Her hands look like they're on fire. Inaudible, I've got to hide them. Faith, I can't believe you really did it, Rosie. Faith, inaudible, get off me. Faith, inaudible, ow. Female, sit up and inaudible. Faith, screams, help. Male, rapping, because inaudible seems to be the one, inaudible, you. Female, fuck you. Male, inaudible, now I'll fuck her. Male, rapping, Faith, inaudible, no. Female, what do you think, inaudible, you? I liked you better, cunt.
Holy shit.
Pardon my use of the C word.
There is so much there.
There is a lot there, and there's a lot of speculation surrounding this voicemail. So let's just dive right into it. So during the call, the male and females use the name Eric and Rosie, respectively. Mm-hmm. I can only find transcribed excerpts of it, but there are ones where they do say Eric. There's also something about like throwing something in a river. It's kind of confusing.
Okay.
Causing speculation that Karina's ex-boyfriend Eric was there.
Yeah.
And that Rosie could in fact be a nickname for Karina's last name, Rosario.
Interesting.
Faith's father is convinced that what was recorded was of his daughter's death.
Yeah.
And West, who is the guy who analyzed it, agrees. However, the outgoing call was timestamped at 1:23 a.m., when the timeline of the night has Faith and Karina out at Thrill. Alternate Reddit theories, which I've read many, say that the recording didn't take place during Faith's death, but in fact at Thrill, the nightclub, and that it records an altercation between Faith, a woman, her boyfriend, perhaps Karina and Eric, and a bouncer. However, and people also say that because you can hear someone like rapping in the background or like singing, and apparently it's the chorus of a song called Booty Work. Do you know that song?
No. Well, I mean, like, if they have them on a security camera at, like, 2:06 a.m., mm-hmm. right? So it's, mm-hmm. like, seems like very likely they would be
right.
in the club.
So then the question is, however, if this heated and aggressive altercation occurred while they were still at the nightclub, why did Faith seem so calm on camera when she left with Karina? Arlo West, for his part, cites that a known software issue with phones like Faith's had actually resulted in inaccurate timestamps.
Uh-huh.
He discounts the background sound as being music, since his analysis did not produce any sounds like percussion, a heavy bass, or synthesizers. And further, he adds that there are none of the background sounds like clinking glasses and others talking that would associate with a nightclub.
Okay.
So basically, you have one, or it's basically like split into two theories. One, that this was recorded as an altercation at the nightclub, in which case that's still a really crucial piece of evidence.
Totally.
And like, might indicate like why Faith was killed that night.
Yep.
Or the timestamp is incorrect.
Yep.
And that this actually was the recording of Faith being murdered.
Which yeah. is, I mean, horrifying.
Horrifying. And I did see an interview with Arlo West, and they kind of asked him, like, what did you know about the case? Like, is there...
Yeah.
Like, could there be any sort of bias going in there? And he was like, I knew very little. And he's like, I've been doing this for decades. Like, I'm not going to put something down that I don't hear.
Right. Totally. I mean, okay.
And Faith's father, take it with a grain of salt, because he could just be, you know, wanting to hear something.
Sure.
But he's convinced that he's like, that is my daughter, like, screaming for her life.
I mean, that is absolutely horrible. I feel like a couple things I take away from it are, like, Rosie, do any of her friends know that she would use that as a nickname for her?
I'm not sure.
Because I feel like that is a little bit of a stretch. And then, like, I guess, like, the duct tape thing mm-hmm. is, like, was there evidence that her hands had been bound with duct tape, or was there any duct tape found? Because that's, like,
yeah,
to me, that's, point. Like, I'm sure if she was, like, my hands are on fire, please, like, there would be, like, some kind of marks around her, like, wrists or something
bound.
Like that.
Yeah, I mean, I've listened to it. The first time I heard it, I didn't have the transcription, and so I was just, like, it sounds just, like, It's we talked about this before when people are like, and here's the evidence of a ghost saying, like,
sure.
You know, I'm here. And it literally just like,
yeah, like, of course.
So that's kind of what it sounds like. But when you have
mm-hmm.
the transcription in front of you, it seems definitely plausible at the very least that some of those words and were there. And it definitely it is not a pleasant conversation.
Right. At the very least, it's like Faith had some kind of altercation, or at least like not a pleasant conversation with Eric probably. Well, like, I can't wait until you tell me why it is that there's not enough evidence for us to convict Eric, because that seems like the obvious one to me.
Well, there's even okay. more damning evidence coming his way.
Okay, great.
So, as I mentioned, police did collect semen from the scene and use it to develop a DNA profile.
Mm-hmm.
It reportedly was consistent with male DNA found elsewhere in the apartment.
Uh-huh.
The first person of interest that arose in this case was Eric Tecoy Jones.
Uh-huh.
Police learned of his history of domestic violence and his threat against Faith. They also found that the night before the murder, around 6 p.m., he had texted an acquaintance asking for forgiveness, in quote, for what I am about to do.
What? Okay. I mean...
and then posted the same message on his Twitter feed. 3 days later, he changed the banner of his Facebook page to read, Dear Lord, forgive me for all of my sins and the sins I may commit today. Okay. Protect me from the girls who don't deserve me and the ones who wish me dead today.
Lol. What the fuck? Okay.
However, when the police sought a DNA sample from Eric, it did not match the one from the apartment and they excluded him as a suspect.
Okay.
DNA from Brandon Edwards and many other men who were found... who police found had been at Thrill during the same time as Karina and Faith were also tested with the same result.
Okay, so they had there was another guy in the apartment at some point that one of them had sex with, and that was the DNA that it was, and it's yeah. still fucking Eric.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, Chapel Hill Police, I have a theory what happened, but
yeah.
we'll get to it. Chapel Hill Police have not named any suspects or even persons of interest in the case. But they have stated that they do not believe the killing was a mere crime of opportunity by a stranger, that instead it was committed by someone in her social group, likely yeah. from someone she knew through UNC Chapel Hill.
Do you think?
There is the middle, of the, like, unless someone's going around, like, trying locks.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you never know.
You never know, but, like, it seems personal to me.
Well, and especially because in Breaking Homicide, one of the biggest things is, so they talk about the murder weapon, which was apparently this rum bottle.
Yeah.
And the first thing they think of is, like, wouldn't that break?
Yeah.
Because she was struck many, many times yep. in the head.
Yeah.
They do a lot of tests on it. It actually does not, it will, and can withstand up to like 500 pounds before oh. it can like shatter.
Wow. So, okay.
Pretty, it's Bacardi like ruby red.
Oh.
In case you want to have some libations as you hear about this horrible murder.
Jesus.
And they also point out like this empty rum bottle, that's not something you bring to, like you're not walking around with that no. as a murder weapon. That's something you find as a,
yeah.
moment of opportunity,
yep. and
a moment of intense rage.
Yes.
Absolutely. I hate the term crime of passion, yep. and I almost just used it because it's like, it's not passion, it is rage.
Yeah. Yeah.
So again, the police are certain that the killer or killers knew Faith and have interviewed more than 2,000 people, and DNA tests have been done on 750 of those.
Oh,
and have reportedly narrowed the pool of 1,000 people down to 10.
Oh, wow.
There's also a possibility that the killer or killers were on the outskirts of Faith's circle of friends and, despite not knowing Faith personally, had been acting out of anger at some grievance that she caused someone closer to her.
Okay.
On September 23rd, 2016, an episode of the ABC News program 2020 included Chapel Hill Police releasing an image generated by Parabon Nanolabs, a genetic testing company in Reston, Virginia, of what the suspect who left the semen might look like based purely on the phenotype of his DNA profile.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. Parabon's president told ABC that Snapshot, the program his company used to create the image, predicts eye color, hair color, skin color, freckling, face morphology, and ancestry. The image included a chart listing the possibility that the suspect had the traits he was assigned. According to the image, the suspect was very strongly Native American and European mixed ancestry or Latino. Most of his genetic markers pointed to Mexican, Colombian, and Iberian.
Okay.
With some other South American and African countries making up the balance. Parabon believed with over 80% confidence that the suspect would have a skin tone in the olive range with very few freckles or none at all and black hair. It did not make any predictions on his height or weight. So...
is that what Eric looks like?
So Eric and Eric, Brandon, Ty Michael McNeil, who's Faith's on and off boyfriend, mm-hmm. are all black.
Okay.
But there are, I'm just so not convinced that.
Yeah.
Because like, I mean, but you're still talking about someone who might be Native American. Like that might be.
Right.
Some, Faith is Native American. Like there's a chance that's also like connected somehow to her or like at least her social circle. I don't
You also know. Just named like 7 or 10 different things that they could have been.
Totally. And again, because we don't know where the semen sample actually came from.
Right.
It could have been like a one night hookup where like someone jizzed on the couch and they're like, oh, we like, because obviously Eric Tocoi Jones has DNA all over that apartment.
Totally.
Like, and their other like on and off again boyfriends, like, so of course it's hard to narrow down, which honestly makes me believe and is echoed in some of these other news sources that I use as research, is that I think the police either know who did it or like are pretty, have like narrowed it down to a couple. They just don't have enough evidence because there's almost like too much evidence, you know, like I feel like they need to, my guess is, because I mean, the murder happened in 2012, which seems like a long time ago, but apparently like it's not that cold for a cold case.
Sure.
And there's also hopes that through like familial DNA and like 23andMe that people will.
Yeah. Well, it's not one of those
forward and.
Yeah, it's totally not one of those cases where they're like, we just have nothing to go off of.
Yeah.
It's like, no, you have so everything. Much.
You could not, you probably wish you had less evidence.
Yeah. Okay.
So, however, there's been a lot of criticism of how the case has been handled by the police. Aside from withholding evidence from the public for so long, like where you think that, I mean, I guess I don't know about the procedures of like releasing evidence, but like my thought would be like, if you have control of what's being released to the public, especially if it's closer to the murder, like maybe there's someone who's like, oh, I actually like when that thing is fresh, you have a witness who's like, oh, I actually do remember seeing them at this time.
Totally.
Whatever.
Right. Especially because there's a lot of people they saw that night. Like there must have been.
Oh, yeah. And I think they have figured out at least a lot of people that were at the nightclub with them. But I don't know. Blah, blah, blah.
The other thing I would say is that if they did have that big of an altercation at the nightclub, you would think there'd be like witnesses.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
That's a super good point, actually. Mm. There's also a theory that the recording on the voicemail actually is picking up just like not them and other people talking, but I doubt it. I feel like you'd have to be pretty close proximity.
Yeah.
And since Faith's father is like pretty sure that that's his daughter's voice.
Sure.
But sometimes you hear what you want to hear.
Right.
Furthermore, two of the neighbors at the apartment complex said that while police sealed off the four-unit block where Faith and Karina lived with crime scene tape, they only searched the women's apartment and not the others nearby. Nor did they search the woods behind the apartments, of which there is apparently plenty, and they returned later to search only one other apartment in the complex. They did not seem to canvass the area either, knocking on doors and asking residents what they might have seen. The police also left Faith's car unsecured while they searched the apartments.
Great.
So, for what it's worth, police sources say that they still regularly speak with Karina Rosario and that she cooperates. However, they do believe that there is more Karina can tell them, and it sounds as if Karina had been in the crosshairs, and that she is a key figure who knows more than she says, and that she and. More than she says and more than she knows. There's also an unsubstantiated claim that on the night of the murder, Karina was seen wearing a shirt with a small red stain on it. That was indeed collected by police, but with no public conclusive statement surrounding it.
Okay.
And personally, to kind of start to wrap things up, because then I feel like there's much to discuss. I have to agree that I think that there's far too many unanswered questions surrounding Karina and her involvement in what was going on, which are, one, why would she leave the apartment door unlocked when she knew Faith was inside alone and her abusive ex had broken in not once but twice in recent months?
Totally.
Weird. Two, why did she leave the apartment at 4:30 a.m. with two men to begin with when she had apparently left Thrill complaining of stomach problems?
Right.
I get it. Sometimes you boot and rally.
Totally.
You're 19. You have a lot more longevity in the night.
But
still seems very convenient.
Yeah.
Three, why did she wait until 11 a.m. to call 911 when Marisol said they found the body at 10 a.m.? That's actually one thing I haven't really been able to clarify. That's a little bit hearsay, but neither here nor there.
Totally.
Four, why did she tell the 911 dispatcher that she wasn't alone? And why wouldn't she refer to Faith or herself by name, only that it was her friend who appeared to be unconscious, despite the fact, as she kept saying, there's blood everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Did she purposely bring Marisol back as a witness? Was Brandon Edwards the original target for that role? Remember, she's the one that was texted from Faith's phone saying, hey, B, can you come over?
Yep.
Like, Rosario needs you.
Yep.
And who Karina herself tried to call several times.
Mm-hmm.
But after he failed to respond to those texts, she sent him from Faith. So, sorry, like, the theory is, like, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
Karina write the note saying, I'm not stupid, bitch? And Faith responded, writing jealous, which could have sparked something. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Can she explain the details of the voicemail? Was the music in the background just the sounds of a nightclub or music being put on to drown out Faith's screams and cries for help?
Right.
And lastly, is she in fact Rosie?
There's so much. Oh my God.
I want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah.
I want to hear your thoughts.
Well, the first thing I was going to ask is, maybe we don't know this because it sounds like the police haven't been sharing like anything, but is there a time of death that they've been able to get from the body?
I don't know, because that's actually a really good point, because that's a big question is, when did Faith die?
Yeah.
So the neighbor downstairs heard thumping sounds around 2:30.
Sure.
So was Faith murdered right when she got back from...
Right. Like, was she dead the whole time? They were texting from her phone. She's already dead.
Mm-hmm. In which case, brings up the question. That's a really good point. Like, who... So if let's say Karina's murdered at 2:30 a.m.
Yeah.
Karina doesn't leave the apartment until 4:30. Like, mm-hmm. So in that two-hour span, that's a lot of time to clean up.
Yep.
Get yourself showered.
Yep.
Plant evidence, reorganize the body.
Absolutely.
And whatnot, and then leave basically leave, get picked up with an alibi that, so if you're able to be like, oh my God, she was murdered after 4:30.
Yep.
I was with her for those 2 hours. No one else can corroborate that.
Right. And you're texting from her phone, making people believe that you're alive.
Her Facebook.
Yes.
All these things that I find extremely suspicious.
Totally.
And feels... I mean, I think that Faith was murdered shortly after returning from the club, mm-hmm. and that those texts were not sent by her. I think they were sent as divergent. And the theory I was proposing was like, maybe Karina, whether she was involved directly or indirectly involved, mm-hmm. texted Brandon Edwards being like, hey, come over, hoping that he would find the body.
Mm-hmm.
When that didn't work, she then had Marisol the next morning come with her to find the body. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't think there's any way that she's not directly or indirectly involved.
I mean, I would say to give her the benefit of the doubt, knowing that she's been so unwilling to talk about it,
mm-hmm.
you could also maybe argue that like if she is more indirectly involved and it's really more a fault of Eric, that she's afraid to speak out against him because she's afraid like for her own life.
Yeah.
Like that could be entirely possible. And maybe there's more that she's told the police than has been released to the public. And maybe she's just not willing to talk to the public because of him. But I would tend to agree that like, I just don't know. I just can't see how she would not be involved.
Or at least not know who did it.
Right.
There's also, I mean, there's so much speculation about her relationship with Faith because.
Yeah.
So it seems like while the two of them were best friends, Faith was the really like outgoing and bubbly and one that like everyone seemed to love. Whereas Karina was much more reserved and while still like a partier, just like was kind of more on the fringes. And there's a lot of photos showing of like Faith, like in like them all being a big group and like Faith is smiling and like hugging people. And like Karina's kind of off to the side. And there's a photo of Karina and Faith where like Faith seems to be kind of like pulling away, whereas like Karina's like leaning in towards her. It's so body language speculation.
Right.
So there are a lot of theories. One, that it was that Eric Tekoi Jones killed her
mm-hmm.
out of rage because she was coming in between his relationship with Karina.
Yeah.
There's a theory that it was Faith's on-off and again boyfriend Ty Michael McNeil,
mm-hmm.
who also apparently had a jealous streak, and that apparently he like hated when she didn't respond to his text messages, and he had texted her like 6 p.m. being like, are we hanging out tonight?
Mm-hmm.
Which then, remember, she got those like weird like proclamation of love. It was basically like, I love you more than you'll ever know, like I think of you as my life, like all these things. Like maybe he sent that as like a weird like post-murder like ego boost.
Sure.
There's the theory that it's just someone that we don't even know. And then even more disturbing that it's multiple people and that potentially it was. And actually, it's the most common theory is that that it was Karina, Eric, and another male
who
all together murdered her.
Right.
For some unknown reason, whether it was jealousy, whether it was the fact that Faith was getting in the way between Karina and Eric's relationship. So, which begs the question, was if that's the case, was Karina a bystander and just like kind of got caught up in this and just like watched her friend get murdered and then just like panicked and didn't know what to do?
Right.
Did she have a part in it?
Oh, my
it's
God.
Really.
So much.
There's so much. I mean, I can't stop thinking about it.
Totally. No, I totally get that. I'm like really fascinated by this, especially because like now, obviously in the age of like modern technology, we have mm-hmm. all of these, like we have all that this digital evidence that we didn't used to have. And like, yeah, it would be so easy to like just send a text from someone's phone.
Oh yeah.
After they were already dead or like,
oh yeah.
And like, yeah, the voicemail is so fascinating and like, I'm yeah. probably going to listen to them. I'm probably going to have to listen to the 911 call.
I think
call.
You should. The 911 call, it's not just, I mean, it's, I think it depends like how you view it. If you listen to it as like, oh my God, this is like a girl stumbling upon her best friend's murdered body, it's really sad.
Yeah.
If it's someone who's pretending like they just found their mm-hmm. best friend's body, that's a horse of different color.
I know.
And I'm still not convinced. I'm actually pretty convinced that it was actually Marisol who made the phone call.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I think that I, because I think I, please don't come after me, everyone, but I feel like Karina was involved more than she says. I don't know how directly, but I think that she knew that Faith was dead. And I think that she left the apartment in the middle of the night so that she could have an alibi. And I think that she came back, she brought a witness with her. And I think that Marisol was the one who called 911. And I think that's the reason. She also, she struggles to remember the address on the operator's like, what's your address? And she's yep. like, I don't know. I just moved in. And it sounds kind of almost like she's being a little coached.
Yeah.
And I think that's why like it takes her a long time. And I think that all, I mean, you know, Karina could be off, you know, off yeah. camera, so to speak. And yeah. when someone's like, who is it? Be like, say it's me.
Yeah. But like why know. Would, I guess like my only question would be like, why would Marisol go along with that?
I don't know. Her interview on Investigation Discovery, I find the most fascinating because she is mess.
Yeah.
Like they interview her parents and her parents are obviously like very stoic and choked up. And obviously they've come to like some sort of
sure.
horrible, you know, coping mechanism of peace to try and like sure. get through.
You, yeah, whatever you can do. Yeah.
But the fact that she's like, she is literally, they're like, describe your relationship with Faith. And Marisol immediately starts crying.
That is weird. I mean, I'm sure like, again, people react to things in different ways. Like just stumbling across a murder scene could be enough to fuck you up, honestly, for the rest
oh, yeah,
of your life.
100%.
Like, that's fair. But yeah, it is. She definitely plays an interesting role in this. And it is, it's just like, it seems like there's so many more answers out there than we know.
Well, yeah, it's, it feels like a combination of the, like, there are witnesses who are withholding things.
Totally.
And the police are withholding things.
Right.
But hopefully, I just would hope that it's in the service of the investigation. And because
sorry, but that time of death thing seems like the first thing you need to fucking figure out in mm-hmm. this timeline. And the fact that that is not like information that's available to anyone is pretty crazy to me. Because as far as I know, you can figure that shit out like pretty much down to a T. Or at least like a few hour span. Like you'd know yes. if she was murdered between the hours of like 2 and 4 versus like
4 and 6
or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, from watching many an episode of Law and Order SVU, I know mm-hmm. sometimes that it's like, was there a window open? Was
right.
the heat on? Like things like that can definitely
of
change.
Course.
I think you take it from the liver temperature.
Okay.
But yeah, I don't know. That's actually weird that I've never seen anything about her time of death,
mm-hmm.
but I know her time of death is big speculation because some people are like, oh, it had to be those thumps that people were, that right. the neighbor was hearing. And other people are like, well, no, it had to be after Karina left the apartment.
Yeah.
Why would she leave it unlocked? That's one of the strangest things.
Well, another thing though, is if she was already dead before Karina left, what reason would she have to leave it unlocked?
So that she could then say, so when she and Marisol come back to the apartment, it's like, oh, I left the door unlocked. That's weird.
Oh, sure. True. I mean, like, I still believe that, like, if she had been drinking, she could have forgotten. But
I mean,
I've
had my fair share of drinking nights, and I've never left my front door unlocked. Granted, we live in New York, and I lived in Boston before this, but, like, and Chapel Hill's a pretty, definitely more of a quaint
yeah.
place.
Right.
But
you have a boyfriend who's broken into your apartment twice.
You've had an abusive boyfriend who's broken into your apartment and twice.
I'm sorry, but like in general, the fact that Faith Faith is living with her, Karina knows that she's putting her in danger to some degree. Like, she has been, like, Faith was specifically threatened. And that's kind of damning to me. It's definitely possible that there was no other choice for them. Like, they had to continue living there, but I just can't imagine, like, putting my best friend in a position like that. But I don't know.
It's crazy. And I really.
Oh, the one last thing I was going to say is, for all of the, like, staging and stuff, the amount that they seem to have, like, confused law enforcement with what they did in terms of, like, sending all these random text messages, like, putting a tampon on the bed, like, putting a random note on the bed, like, that's pretty smart.
Yeah, there's a...
Unless they just lucked out with how bad they were at staging.
Honestly, unless the police know more and they know that she actually was raped and, like, they're right. Like, this wasn't, like, I don't know.
Right.
But yeah, there's a lot of conflicting evidence, and there's a lot of, like, things that don't really add up. Yeah, it's like, why, like, who goes through the efforts of staging it to look like a sexually motivated homicide?
Yeah, why would you do? Well, because I guess you could argue, unless, like, if she's being killed in just, like, a moment of rage and is, like, being hit with a bottle in a fight, that's going to point back to them more so than if they stage it to look like someone broke into the house.
That's true.
I guess.
But it's one thing if she, you know, it's a moment of, like, rage and it's, like, a one strike and she goes down. It's like she was hit many, many, many times.
Yeah. 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 That's not like, oh, I got mad and I hit you and you accidentally died. Mm-hmm. It's like it was
like I saw red and I very, very violently killed you. It's horrible. It's horrible. It's so, so tragic. And yeah. I really hope that in the near future an arrest will be made and we'll have answers.
It seems like this could be solved.
It's the most solvable unsolved murder I've ever heard in my life.
I need to know why Eric is not already in jail.
My guess would be lack of evidence.
Yeah.
And, or lack of, what's the opposite of circumstantial? Because it does seem like if they say, like, right. Oh, you're like, they're like, we found your DNA in the bed sheets, you could easily be like, yeah, I had sex with Karina there, like, 2 days, like, you never know.
Right. Right.
Well, let us know your thoughts. I actually I've really enjoyed reading Reddit theories, and people have some really strong opinions that, I mean, again, like, that Karina killed her out of jealousy or Eric killed her out of, I mean,
I guess there's a possibility that Karina was the one who did everything, but
that is not a not popular theory.
But also, like, I'm not sure that she would have been able to overpower her completely. There were just, like, two, like, 19-year-old girls, like, roughly the same size. Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That is really fascinating. I'm definitely going to be thinking about that one.
Yeah. And yeah, please let us know your thoughts. If you have any theories or if there's anything we missed, evidence and whatnot. I just could talk about this case all day.
So yeah.
And
as always, like, we've talked about this many times before, but, like, if you know anyone who's in a domestic abuse situation, like, please help them seek help. Or if you are in one yourself.
Absolutely.
You know. It's easier said than done, but, like, a lot of many of these cases result from having those kind of violent people in your life. And I mean, if you listened to our episode last week, our little bitch, you know, you might reach out about the fact that you're in a domestic abuse situation and have no one fucking do anything for you. Yeah. So, All right. Well, I guess we can complain a little bit before we go.
Yeah, let's keep it. Do you have a light complaint?
Kind of. I guess my complaint is, like, well, I was starting to tell you about this a little bit, but I went to Chicago recently to visit a friend, and it was, like, over 4th of July weekend. So I was all excited because I was going to come back on Saturday night, and then I was going to have, like, a whole day to just kind of, like, gather myself before going back to work. But my flight was canceled for, like, a very unknown reason, as I've been noticing a lot of people's flights have been canceled recently in the summer, where it's, like, a thunderstorm issue versus, like, in the winter where it's a literal blizzard and JFK is like, we're fine, come on down. Yes. So I ended up getting back like in the late afternoon on Sunday instead. And my complaint really is that it's not even a complaint about like the circumstances that affect plans. It's really like more about the way that I react to the smallest thing changing. Yeah. Is like, I'm sure a larger anxiety issue that I should probably address. But like, I literally like could not recover from how bad of a mood I was in for like the rest of the day on Sunday, yep. knowing that I didn't have the time that I had planned out that I thought I would have.
Yep.
And it's even like the smallest thing of being like, oh, an extra person got added to like the dinner we're going to. And I'm like, I can't wrap my mind around that. Like, it's just like, I don't know if you experience the same kind of thing, but like, I just have like severe anxiety surrounding things that are out of my control because I am a very controlling person. And like, again, probably a larger issue, but it's something that I'm trying to work on.
That's good.
So I guess like if any of you listeners deal with the same problem, is there anything that helps you kind of get through that? Because I really struggle with it and I want to be able to just be like, oh, you want to go to dinner there instead of this other place? That's fine. I definitely didn't spend 40 minutes looking at the menu and deciding what I was going to get already. So that's fine. Like, we can just change the plans at the last minute.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely agree with you with the travel stuff. And I do think that I've found myself in recent years becoming more anxious over little things.
Mm-hmm.
And something that helps is not really to like, be like, oh, Grant, like you're being crazy, like stop it. But just kind of like, in my head, like calling out my own, like when I'm being anxious,
totally,
and overthinking, being like, okay, like this is what's happening. Mm-hmm. This is why you're irritated. Like, why? And also, do you need to be this worked up? Like, is it a kind of thing where like, you're getting yourself worked up because like it's actually something that's really fucking annoying and
totally.
Like it's gonna like ruin like this, which is then gonna ruin this and this and this and this? Or are you getting yourself into that place because that is the way your brain works and you just like automatically go to this place of panic and like frustration when you don't actually need to? And I think sometimes like calling that off and being like, okay, like this isn't an actual thing, it's just like a response that my brain is just like going to, can mm-hmm. sometimes be helpful. But
yeah, no, I think that's really good advice. And just like acknowledging when it is something that is actually super annoying and it's fine for you to be feeling that way, but mm-hmm. also acknowledging when it is not that bad and you can totally move on with your life.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, like, if you're having a panic attack, if you sit there being like,
don't. Yeah, but I'm not getting to that place, but other people obviously
but,
do.
But like, if one is having a panic attack mm-hmm. and you sit there being like, oh my God, I'm panicking, yeah. it's going to make it 10 times worse because you're fueling the fire, as opposed to being like, if I'm having a panic attack, being like, okay, mm-hmm. this is happening. It's going to pass.
Yeah.
This is one moment. Get me to the next moment.
Yeah.
Whatever. Like, it's going to be okay. Like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, mm-hmm. 15 minutes from now.
Right.
Like this little thing won't matter in the long run.
This too shall pass.
Easier said than done, but sometimes just like talking yourself down in those ways can sometimes be helpful.
Yeah.
I want to complain about it, not that this happens like too recently, but somehow this like concept like got brought up to me and it just like made me so angry
mm-hmm.
of people like when like, you know, when you're at a party.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not really, but sure.
Or you're at a social gathering.
Uh-huh.
And there's a person who's just like, oh, should I break out the guitar?
Oh my
or
God.
Like, oh, like, let me like show you like this like talent I have. Like, oh, like, do you want to hear about like this like song I've been working on? Or like, oh, like just like, and like no one is talking about something like, hey, like, I hear you write your own music. Like, I'd love to hear some songs. Uh-huh. It's always like, oh, by the way. And it's always at college dorm parties, which is like,
yeah, let's like, just is that a guitar?
Oh my God.
It's like, yep, it is.
Gotta play it. And those people just like feel the need to insert their talents into conversations and settings that do not involve.
Oh my God. That's so funny. It's like, it's literally that classic meme of like the, anyway, here's Wonderwall.
No.
It's like,
but actually.
I'm actually good.
And it'd be one thing if someone's like, hey, like, do you mind if, like, mm-hmm. I've been working on this, I'd love to get your input. And it's like, oh my God, of course. But it's like, if you're in like a large group and you're just mm-hmm. like, you know, let me just, can I have the aux cord for a second? Like, do you guys want to hear like my SoundCloud?
Oh no, it's always like, it's a larger, that larger phenomenon of just like deciding that you're going to dominate a large social situation when like the invitation was like not presented to you to do so. It's like I feel like there were so many college parties where we'd be like, It would be like, oh my God, you guys have to see this like hilarious YouTube video. And then mm-hmm. it would be like a 12-minute video and everyone would just kind of like be talking through it. And they just like keep turning it up being like, no, like the funny part is coming mm-hmm. up. And you're like, okay, great. But like we were actually just having a conversation. So like, let's do this later.
Seriously.
Speaking of college parties, should we tell them about that time that you did that thing?
Would you like to?
I feel like you maybe know the details better than I did.
So from my recollection, let's set the scene. This is probably spring 2011.
Yeah.
And Bailey and I and a couple of other friends were just like having like a really sensible dorm gathering, mm-hmm. drinking our jungle juice.
Sure.
I'm pretty sure my hair was spiked for the gods. I was wearing like jean cutoff shorts that like went probably like below my, like went like right to the knee, mm-hmm. like really cute. Mm-hmm. And we were sitting in a common room in the dorm I was living in, whilst very intoxicated. And I proceed to like sit down on the floor, like next to a completed puzzle.
I would say like it's at least 1,000 pieces. Like yes. This is an intricately like artistic, beautiful puzzle.
That a completed some people... Star Wars puzzle.
Yes.
And you know those like I find myself like with these find these impulses like all the time. Just like, well, like yesterday I was walking to the subway and I like passed like a bunch of people like having happy hour outside and like they'll have like, a glass of rosé and I just had the thought of like, what if I just like punch that glass of rosé over? Or what if, yes. like you go to, like, a Broadway show and you think, like, what if I just, like, stood up in the middle and just was, like, ah! what would happen? Those right. weird, like,
what if I just didn't follow societal rules yeah. for 1 second? Yeah. yeah.
And in this moment, I sure didn't. And I, with both hands, just destroyed that puzzle.
Funniest thing I've ever seen. Like, we have no idea if this puzzle belonged to. Let's be clear. Like, a couple of strangers, like, got together on a Saturday afternoon in our common room and, like, put this very... quietly put this puzzle together and within seconds the pieces were everywhere. Grant's just like, ah! I was like, oh my God, okay.
I don't know what came over me. I just had this impulse and you know this raspberry flavored Smirnoff and Diet uh-huh. Coke mixture had just like gone to my head and I just needed, I saw that puzzle and I was like, I need to fuck this up. We have a picture of it. We can post it.
Oh my God, we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got to post that.
A disposable camera Facebook photo of me, thumbs up, grinning from ear to ear. Never been happier with my own work.
Next to all the strewn about puzzle pieces. Oh you know my God.
It had to be done.
I mean, you're right. You had no choice.
I had no choice. You know, my hands were tied, but I like 50%, I'm like, I want to apologize to that person for destroying their puzzle. And the other part of me is like, I'm not sorry because what a great memory.
It's the greatest thing I've ever witnessed. What a
great time in my life. I'm surprised you never mentioned that.
I know. I really love that. Well, hopefully that that little tidbit like helps to brighten up this incredibly dark podcast just a little bit for you. But as always, thank you guys for listening. Please let us know your theories on this incredibly fascinating case because
please.
We got to solve it. So, yes, as always, you please rate, review, and subscribe on, you know, iTunes or wherever you listen to this Apple podcast. iTunes doesn't even exist anymore.
We're not on Sound. I mean, we're not on
We're not on Spotify. We're not on Spotify, but sorry, we're on SoundCloud, Stitcher, whatever. You can email us at rwfpodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at rwf. You know what it is.
Context clues, RWF podcast.
Thank you guys so much, and we'll see you next week. Bye bitches.